Okay, it's my very great pleasure to welcome those who are joining online. I can see there are quite a number of you and joining in the in-person audience as well. My name is David Erdos. I'm the co-director of the Centre for IP and Information Law, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Henry Pearce, who is from the University of Portsmouth, senior lecturer there, also deputy editor of Computer Law and Security Review, a leading figure in the world of information law and data protection, and is going to talk about a really topical issue and a really cutting edge issue, which is Brexit, data protection reform, and whether we can and whether we should lead on to a harms-based conceptualization of data protection. I don't wish to steal his thunder, so I will stop at that point. Do think about questions, issues, things you want to discuss, because there will be time for questions and answers after Henry's presentation. But I will now hand over to Henry for the presentation itself. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, David, for the introduction. And thank you also very much for the invitation to come and speak to you all today. It's a pleasure to be here. And yes, as David has already mentioned, today I'm here to talk in some detail about everyone's favorite topic, which is Brexit, because we haven't heard enough about that over the last however many years. But of course, as well as Brexit, I will be looking at the impact this has had on data protection law in the UK and the current status quo with regards to how the data protection framework might look in the future and how it could look in the future. So the starting point for everything I'm going to talk about today is, of course, Brexit. The UK, as we all know, left the European Union at the start of 2020. And a consequence of that is that the UK, as it is no longer an EU member state, is no longer bound by the doctrine of supremacy. To that end, the UK, since this time, has enjoyed what some have coined a newfound legislative freedom to diverge from EU law rules and forge its own path in a number of different areas and fields. One area that has been identified as a particularly interesting avenue for post-Brexit reform, where this newfound legislative freedom might be put to better to good use, is data protection law and the UK's data protection framework. So for anybody who is not aware of what data protection law does, it is the body of law that establishes rules, restrictions, and rights in relation to individuals' personal data. So personal data about data and information about us, in other words. This ethos, this push towards reform in this area is perhaps summed up quite nicely by this quote by Oliver Dowden, who at the time of speaking was the Secretary of State for the DCMS, where he very pithily put it, "We do not need to copy and paste the EU's rule book, the General Data Protection Regulation, word for word." So the General Data Protection Regulation is the EU's foremost piece of data protection legislation. And as a regulation, it is directly applicable to all EU member states. As the UK is no longer an EU member state, this piece of legislation is not directly applicable in the UK, but nonetheless, it has been retained in the UK as a form of retained EU legislation in the form of the UK's UK General Data Protection Regulation, the UK GDPR. Despite this, however, the drive and urge for reform has never seemingly been particularly far away. So, on the 10th of September in 2021, the Department for Digital Culture and Sport launched its consultation paper on the idea of data protection reform with the ultimate aim of building what it referred to as a bold new data regime. This resulted in the production and introduction of two new data protection and digital information bills that ultimately went nowhere, having faced some quite heavy criticism. But despite the change of government that we experienced or enjoyed earlier in the year, this sort of spectre or threat or opportunity of reform, depending on how you look at it, has never been far away. And in the last few weeks, the recently elected Labour government has put forward its new proposal for a new data use and access bill. So many provisions from the failed and heavily criticised bills that the Conservative government put forward have been retained in this new bill by that's been put forward by the Labour government. And unfortunately, despite purporting to be bold and innovative and envisaging a fresh and forward-looking approach to data protection, much like the previous failed bills, this bill, to my mind, is somewhat unambitious and disappointing. Despite purporting to be very innovative and forward-looking, to me, it's not really anything of the sort. And what this bill does, as the failed bills before it did, is envisage a model of data protection law that I think in a lot of ways is outdated and possibly unsustainable. So to this end, although we are engaging with reform here and thinking about what it might look like, we are also witnessing what might represent a missed opportunity to genuinely think creatively about what data protection law in the UK could be and forge a new path perhaps of developing data protection law in a way that makes it fit for purpose in our contemporary digital and information society. And the reason why I would consider this model of data protection set out in this bill and the bills before it as being unambitious and not great, frankly, partly anyway, is because the model of data protection that these bills have envisaged are all based around the concept of personal data. So the rules of the UK GDPR that we have at the moment and the model of data protection that is envisaged by this new proposed bill apply exclusively to uses of personal data and not to any other types of information. So personal data is the key enabling concept or trigger around which all data protection rules and rights are based. But very simply, if you are processing, in other words, using personal data in any way, the law will apply to you in its entirety. But if you are not using personal data in any way, the law will not apply to you at all. So it is a key, critical, central concept. And therefore, with that being the case, with it being a concept of such importance, a clear understanding of what personal data means, what kinds of things constitute personal data, this is critical for the smooth interpretation, application, and enforcement of the law. So the definition that we have, that we're given by the UK GDPR, and this definition is by and large the one that is used by the proposed Data Use and Access Bill, is set out under Article 4.1 of the UK GDPR that tells us personal data is any information relating to an identified or identifiable natural person. Now, unfortunately, there are several conceptual or semantic problems inherent in this definition that necessarily give rise to vagueness and confusion. And these difficulties have been and will continue to be exacerbated by developments in information technology. So in my mind, the upshot of these difficulties is that this personal data-based approach to data protection law and regulation could be in danger of becoming unfit for purpose, if arguably it's not or has not become that already. So if we break this definition down, there are three main problematic elements that we can pick out, or at least these are the three I've picked out, but there may be more. The first is the requirement that in order to be personal data, information must relate to somebody. The second is that the information must relate to a person who is identified or identifiable. And the third problematic element are just these words, information and data themselves. So if we look at these one by one, we can unpick exactly why these terms do give rise to problems, confusion, and vagueness. So the first problematic element is this requirement that information must relate to somebody. So this immediately gives rise to the question of, well, what do we mean by relate by? What does it relate to? Sorry. When will information relate to somebody? What does it mean for information to be relating to someone? So UK courts have given some definition of what this term means. In the Edam case, for example, the Court of Appeal held that information will relate to somebody when it is obviously about them. Nothing wrong with that. That sounds quite logical and straightforward. If information is about somebody, then that, yeah, makes sense that that would be considered personal. But the scope of this concept doesn't stop there. It is more expansive than that. Even if information is not about somebody, according to the Court of Justice of the European Union, it will still relate to them if it is used to evaluate them, treat them a certain way, influence their behavior, or is used in a way that will impact their rights and interests. So this is a very, very broad standard. It necessarily captures a huge amount of information. If information will relate to somebody when it is used to influence them a certain way, for example, this necessarily means that a huge amount of information that has no obvious relationship to or connection with a person could potentially relate to them. So an example that is sometimes given is that data about general retail patterns in a shop that perhaps do not specifically identify or focus on any one individual could be used to inform targeted marketing strategies. So these strategies are designed to influence people's behavior. So according to the CJEU standards set out in the Novak case I mentioned on the previous slide, this type of information would relate to somebody according to that standard. This is very, or potentially anyway, very problematic for data controllers, the people or parties to whom data protection rules generally apply. Because when it comes to them attempting to consider whether information at their disposal is personal or not, they will potentially have to contemplate a significant number of very difficult questions that may not be easy to answer, depending on the context of what they're doing. It's not, for example, enough for them just to ask, is this information about somebody that we have here? In order to fully answer the question of whether information relates to somebody, they would have to ask, is this information going to be used to influence someone's behavior? Is it going to affect somebody if we use this information? This process of identifying what information relates to somebody according to this very expansive standard can be very time-consuming and very resource-intensive. And even then, it may be very difficult to work out whether information relates to somebody or not. This, unfortunately, is a problem that will only likely worsen with the passage of time and with the evolution and development of information technologies. The reason for this is that is essentially datafication. So we live in a world now where key aspects of our lives are increasingly transformed into digital data, either through social media usage, wearing smart wearable technologies, participating in or moving through sensor embedded physical environments. And it is these smart, pervasive computing enabled connected environments that are particularly interesting here. If we think about what happens in smart environments and think about the Novak standard of or criteria for when information will relate to somebody, we can think about how really in smart cities or smart homes or wherever we might be, essentially all the information that is gathered and generated in those environments is done so with the intention of adapting the environment in question and therefore influencing the people in the environment. So in other words, all the information in that is generated in a smart environment will likely relate to the people in it. So for example, data gathered in a smart city might be used to discourage deviant behaviors or to adjust the brightness of street lights or the speed of escalators, or to influence decisions regarding how individuals dress, whether they take an umbrella in the morning when they leave, or how they travel. The high dimensionality of the data in these environments will also likely mean it's possible to identify people from those data. With that being the case, it means all this data legally would count as personal data. It would constitute personal data. And in such an environment, this would mean that the processing of personal data is literally everywhere. It is all around us all the time. Data are being generated, sent, received, analyzed, exchanged from the devices on our person, from other sensors in the environments. And if data protection law applies to the processing of personal data, and the processing of personal data is literally inherent in more or less everything we do, that means that data protection law itself will end up applying to nearly everything that we do. So this is what some critics like Nadia Patova have coined. They've suggested it will mean data protection law effectively becomes the law of everything. I can't remember where this quote comes from, and I always forget to look it up. I think it might have been Lon Fuller who said this, but a law that applies to everything may as well apply to nothing, because it cannot be enforced meaningfully or consistently, and it cannot be complied with meaningfully or consistently. It is a sign of a bad law, for lack of a better words. So this deals with the first problematic criteria, constituent element of the personal data definition. But the notion of identified or identifiable is another problematic element. So we mentioned at the start, personal data is any information relating to an identified or identifiable person. So again, we need to know, what does this mean? When will somebody be identifiable? What does it mean to be identified? This is important because data protection law, as we mentioned at the start, operates on a personal anonymous data dichotomy. If you're processing personal data, the law applies to you completely. But if the data you are processing, for example, are anonymous and apply to do not identify anyone, then the law does not apply to you at all. There is a hard dividing line between personal data, to which the law applies, and anonymous data, which the law does not apply in any way whatsoever. If data cannot be used to identify anybody, then they will be legally anonymous. Case law and regulatory guidance from the Information Commissioner's Office, the UK's data protection regulator, and other quite authoritative observers generally seem to establish that a person will be identifiable if they can be distinguished from other members of a group. So, for example, if we have a spreadsheet with various columns in that contain personal information like a person's height, weight, ethnicity, whatever it might be, and if we can point to one record in that database, that spreadsheet, and say, I know that that is my friend Dave, then Dave is clearly identifiable because we can distinguish him from others. However, it is not entirely clear how distinguishable a person needs to be before legally, from information, before legally we can say they are identified. And case law presents a rather muddled and difficult picture with regards to the answering of this question. So in the Breyer case, for example, the Court of Justice of the European Union appeared to establish that identifiability, in its words, is a matter of context and degree. In order to work out in any particular situation whether somebody is identifiable from information, we need to look at the context surrounding how that information is used, what is being used for, who has access to it, and the general environment of those data. This seemingly implies that an interpretation of the personal data concept based on the idea of risk of identification, was compatible with the definition set out in Article 4 of the UK GDPR. So, the EU GDPR. So in the Breyer case, the court appeared to imply that an interpretation of personal data whereby information would only be personal data if there was a certain level of risk of identification would be a perfectly valid interpretation of the notion of identifiability in the context of the definition that would be compatible with the definition of personal data in the EU GDPR. Now, UK case law presents a muddled picture in this regard. Although the Breyer case appeared to establish a possible risk-based approach to identifiability, cases from the upper and first-tier tribunals dealing with data protection issues have seemed to disagree about whether or not this is a valid interpretation or not. In some decisions, for example, like the Queen Mary case, the first-tier tribunal appeared to say, yes, we can take an approach to personal data which hold that if there's a significant risk of identification, that's enough to say somebody is identifiable from us from information. Whereas other decisions like the Spivak case appear to completely reject this and say, no, a risk of identification is not enough. We can only say information or personal data if identification is, as a question of fact, completely possible. A risk will not do. So again, we now have another sort of a muddled and unclear picture about what, or how at least, some of the core constituent elements of the definition of personal data should be understood. This again makes it very difficult potentially for data controllers to work out whether information at their disposal is personal data or not. So more practical problems about how we should apply the definition or how it should be understood. And as a result, because simply when, whether, and at which point data legally become anonymous is not entirely clear. So very difficult from a practical point of view. And once again, this is a problem that has been worsened and maybe made worse even further by developments in information technology. So historically, over the last half a century or so, one way of getting around these sorts of problems and avoiding all of the difficulties with not knowing whether information are personal data or not would be to use an anonymization technique. Now, these are frequently used by data controllers. They're their technological tools, mathematical tools that are used to convert personal data into an anonymous form. There are various different ways through which this can be done. I'm not going to get into all of these at this point in time because that would take a very long time and it's very technical and not particularly interesting. Well, apologies to anyone who is interested in that who's listening, but I'm not an expert in this. What will be sufficient for our purposes today is just to think of anonymization techniques as these technical tools that you can use to convert personal data into an anonymous form. And of course, if they are anonymous legally, they are no longer personal and will not fall within the scope of data protection rules. So traditionally, these techniques have been used by data controllers to dissolve any data protection obligations they have and remove data they possess from the scope of data protection rules. Ergo, eliminating any chance of breaking the law unintentionally. The problem is, whilst for a long time it was thought that anonymization of, or perfect, irreversible, absolute anonymization of personal data was possible, and that use of these techniques would offer permanent cast iron guarantees of anonymity, this has unfortunately been exposed as a false position over the last 15 or so years. In reality, mathematicians and computer scientists have shown that perfect anonymization, which guarantees permanent, irreversible, universal anonymity of data, it simply mathematically cannot be done. It is impossible. It cannot be achieved. This is problematic for data protection law because the definition of personal data and the way we've seen that the law applies to personal data but not anonymous data, the way the law is set up presumes there is a hard dividing line between personal data and data that are anonymous. In reality, this hard dividing line does not exist anymore, if it ever did. It is now a very blurry line. It is very difficult to successfully anonymize data these days. The fact that this line has become very blurry when the law appears to presume it's a hard, permanent, very robust line raises very difficult questions in respect of whether it makes sense to persist with a model of law that is based on this personal anonymous data dichotomy, because these things do not exist in absolute states. Nowadays, it is still possible to contextually or functionally anonymize personal data, ensuring that data are anonymous if they're used for certain purposes only, for example, or within the context of certain environments. It can still be done, just not universally or permanently or perfectly. But to determine whether or not your use of an anonymization technique is successful, it will often require expert guidance, input, and specialist knowledge. Against this background, we can ask, well, if expert or specialist input is required simply to comply with the law, this again raises questions in relation to whether the law itself is fit for purpose. Can a law really be good if you need an expert to work out whether or not you are complying with it? Maybe or maybe not. There are issues regarding things like the principle of legality that are quite challenging here. Anyway, the final constituent element of the personal data definition are just these words, information and data themselves. So the definition, just to remind everybody, of personal data is that personal data are information that relates to an identified or identifiable person. So this definition is somewhat circular. It never actually explains what the words information or data mean. And this absence of any explanation or interpretation is reflected in case law, the data protection case law, where the courts have generally just treated these words very sort of nonchalantly in some ways as straightforward interchangeable terms without ever really sort of trying to dig into them and elucidate what they actually mean or how they are different from one another. There just seems to be a common understanding that information is information, we know what that is, and everyone knows information, and data is information in a different form. It is information about information. These are just words we have a common understanding of. No need to really get into this in any detail. This is somewhat jarring because in other related disciplines to law, like philosophy, information and data are not just regarded as being conceptually very distinct, but also very, very complicated and intricate. So there is a disconnect between how the law treats these terms and how they are treated within other disciplines. In the law, as we say, there's barely any recognition or attempts to disambiguate or investigate what these words actually mean. But in other disciplines, they are recognized as being hugely complex. So in the context of, to refer to this author, Luciano Floridi, in the context of information, regarding, let's say, an iris scan to open a door, information that is collected in that context can come in many forms. We might have information as reality, for example, which would be the pattern of the membrane in someone's eye that actually opens a door. We may have information for reality, which is the biometric means to open a door by verifying somebody's identity from their iris scan. And then we might have information about reality, which would be the identity of the person who is actually opening the door. Data is another concept that is also poorly elucidated and understood. When we mention data, people tend to think of raw data, particularly in the context of data protection law. We might think about, we say data, we think about things like I mentioned earlier, figures in a spreadsheet, statistics regarding somebody's height, names, addresses, that kind of stuff. But data is much more complicated than just raw statistics, figures, and pieces of information. Other forms of data include metadata, operational data, or derivative data, for example. But these complicated nuances are not really reflected in the law, either in legislation or in case law. The upshot of that is that the terms information and data could potentially apply to far more things, far more information types and data types than data controllers might commonly assume. And the upshot of that, or rather, now I've got ahead of myself a bit here. In this situation, not only are these terms, let's say, philosophically and conceptually underexplored, but in our contemporary information society, what we are seeing are physical objects being increasingly mined for information. Because of this, it arguably is becoming increasingly difficult to justify any distinction between information and data themselves and the physical material that constitute their medium. So the upshot of this, if we allow for this sort of, if we entertain this thought, what we may see is physical items themselves constituting personal data, as opposed to just the purely intangible information that would other constitute personal data. This further widens the scope of the definition of personal data and further can cause difficulties in terms of identifying whether information at our disposal are personal or not. And that obviously raises problems regarding compliance with the law. Anyway, to sum up everything I've said so far, and I'll move on to saying what I actually think we should do about this situation potentially in a moment, is just to highlight the sort of crux of the point I've tried to get across here, which is personal data is a vague, indeterminate, and possibly unlimitedly expansive concept. Over the last 20 years, we've seen that determining whether or when information will be personal data has been an extremely difficult task for data controllers, and this is a task that I think is only likely to increase with time. Not only this, but as we've seen, as well as difficulties regarding determining what is and is not personal data, there is also the chance of the concept of personal data becoming so wide that it applies to practically everything we do, making it unworkable. So this definition, basing personal data around this concept of personal data as it is defined at the moment, is potentially very problematic. And I think there are serious questions that can be asked about whether or not this is a sustainable approach to law and regulation in this area. And I think this is summed up quite nicely by this quote. This quote is from a friend of mine, just said this off the cuff when we were having a chat about these things a couple of years ago. I hadn't identified him because he works for the Information Commissioner's Office and didn't want to have this attributed to him. But I thought it summed up the current situation quite well. So he just said, we were sat down at a cafe somewhere, and he just said to me, the whole world is getting more and more unclear, which is odd, as ordinarily you would expect the introduction of some new law, he was referring to the GDPR here, to make things clearer. It seems to me that as time goes on, we are essentially going in reverse. And I think, although he wasn't necessarily specifically referring to the concept of personal data at the time, that was part of the conversation we were having. And I think it just sums up the whole current status quo quite nicely. So the question then becomes, well, where do we go from here? If personal data is not going to be the central, or if it shouldn't be the central focal point of data protection regulation, what else could we do? What could the law be instead? How else could we do it? And one possible approach would be to shift to a model of information harms, an information harms-based approach to data protection law. So under such an approach to law in this area, instead of the law's first question being, are you processing personal data or not? Because if you are, the law applies to you. And if you're not, the law doesn't apply to you. Instead of doing things that way, data protection rules could instead be triggered according to the level of harm inherent in specific data processing operations, regardless of whether information being processed in those operations were nominally personal or not. So rather than focusing on whether a data controller, for example, is processing personal data for any particular purpose and saying the law must apply to you if you're doing that, the law could start from saying, well, actually, we're going to look at specifically at what you are doing, not whether you're using personal data, but what you're actually doing and what the consequences of that are likely to be. So under such an approach, we could say harm could be expressed as a function of probability and severity, by which I mean harm could be the probability of a harm occurring measured against the severity of that harm should it occur. And then data protection rules could be applied on a sliding scale according to a particular activity's overall harm level or risk level or whatever you might want to call it. Exactly how that can be done, we could get onto in a moment. But obviously, for this approach to work, we need to have an idea of what harm is, what the different categories of harm might be, and how we could indeed conceptualize harm in this context. So to this end, what I did was have a look at various pieces of regulatory guidance from the UK, from the USA, from other EU countries, and develop a taxonomy of different information harm types. So in particular, I looked at guidance given by the UK Information Commissioner's Office, the French Data Protection Regulator, CNIL, the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the USA, all of whom have produced guidance notes on how to conceptualize information harms. Broadly speaking, having collated examples from all these different sources, it's possible to break down crudely, and this is not the only way you could do it, but it is an example of how you could do it, information harms into four different categories, ranging from negligible, which are, as we see, minor annoyances and things like that, ranging all the way up to very serious harms, which could involve things like permanent injury and death. So it is possible, I think, and evidently there are pieces of regulatory guidance across the world that recognize different categories of information harm. And as they are already out there, they act as a guide for categorizing information harms. There doesn't seem to be any obvious reason why, to me, they couldn't form part of the law itself. So with these in mind, with these four categories of harm, to plot an overall harm level, we could use a risk matrix like this and give a data protection processing activity, whatever it is, an overall harm level. So if we imagine on one axis, doesn't really matter which, we have the different levels of harm were on the previous slide. And along the bottom, we have, or along the other axis, we have the probability of that harm occurring. So let's say we have a very high level of harm. We identify a processing activity is capable of causing very severe harm, but it is very unlikely. So let's say we have severity of harm on the vertical axis. So 4, but it is very unlikely. 1, we might say it has a very moderate harm. As an example, I'm going to move on quickly so that we don't run out of time, but this is how we could, by using something like this, calculate an overall harm level inherent in a data processing activity by measuring the severity of the harm against the probability of its occurrence. Once we've done that and we can decide whether or not a processing activity's harm level is either maximum, very high, moderate, low, very low, or minimal, the law can then be applied on a sliding scale. I'm not going to read out all of this because that would take ages and I don't think much would be gained by doing that. But we could see, for example, if a particular processing activity was identified as being maximum level of harm, this would mean that the law could say it is essentially prohibited. A very high level of data protection rules, restrictions, requirements, and so on would be applied to that activity. It'd be regulated in a very strict and rigorous way. Conversely, at the other end of the scale, if a processing activity was deemed to be of minimal harm, essentially no legal rules would apply to it. And in between, we would have the severity, strictness of the law being applied on a sliding scale. So I think there are numerous merits to, potential merits anyway, to moving to a model of data protection that is based on in that vein, shall we say. The first is that if we move to a harms-based approach, away from a personal data-focused approach, this allows the law to prioritize the actual consequences of data misuse and harmful uses of personal data, rather than focusing on the mere presence of personal data itself, which is maybe an unhelpful thing to do, even if we can do that effectively, which maybe we can't. This would hopefully ensure that regulatory efforts would be targeted where there's a real risk of harm and bad stuff occurring. And that would, help us dissolve these problems that have stemmed from becoming so fixated on the concept of personal data itself. By assessing the specific context and nature of each data processing activity, this approach would also allow for a more nuanced and tailored regulatory response to a lot of emerging challenges in this area. And as a result, this could allow the law to adapt better to evolving technologies and practices, because this isn't something that's going to stop, providing a more dynamic legal framework. The definition of personal data was designed in another world, essentially. Now it was first drafted a long, long time ago. I can't remember the exact date, but at least before the 1980s, we've had data protection law in some form from the Republic of Hesse, for example. Under such an approach, organizations handling large amounts of data and using the data for all sorts of purposes may also be incentivized to proactively manage real risks, rather than becoming fixated on ensuring compliance with predefined rules. One major problem with data protection law at the moment is that it is perceived by a lot of people as being a compliance exercise. It is sort of a tick box thing, much like health and safety requirements are perceived to be a nuisance, just something that companies have to do, for example. This is very unhelpful from a data protection point of view. Moving to a harm-based approach could perhaps, hopefully, and I may be somewhat optimistic in thinking this, could help raise overall standards of data protection and then foster a sort of pro data protection friendly practices potentially. Focusing on the harm rather than the technicalities of whether personal information are classified as personal data or not could also reduce unnecessary regulatory burdens. One problem stemming from the lack of clarity over the definition of personal data is not only that data controllers mistakenly think they're not processing personal data when they are, but data controllers thinking they are processing personal data when they are not. This results in overcompliance, data controllers attempting to follow all of the UK GDPR rules when they don't actually need to. This can result in a lot of resources and time being wasted, because this is not cheap or easy stuff to do a lot of the time. And the final sort of merit that I've identified linked to the model of data protection I've sketched out here is that moving to a risk or harm-based approach of data protection law would align data protection law with other associated regulatory frameworks, particularly things like the EU's Artificial Intelligence Act, which already operates on the base, it deploys a risk-based approach to regulation, regulating different uses of AI depending on the level of risk inherent in them. If we can regulate AI on the basis of risk, we can ask, well, why shouldn't data protection and non-AI uses of personal data, for example, be regulated in the same way? So by streamlining regulatory efforts across different domains like data protection and AI, this could simplify compliance with the law for a lot of businesses that are dealing with large amounts of personal data, for example, and those also operating in multiple regulatory environments like international companies habitually do. Unfortunately for me, this is not the idea I've sketched is not a panacea, though. There are many problems inherent with what I have proposed, and I by no means wish to sort of make the case for my idea being a gold standard, a perfect solution, or anything like that. I am well aware of many limitations inherent in it. I merely have set it out as an embryonic example of what we perhaps could have that would dissolve some of the problems inherent in the incumbent model. For the sake of completeness, though, I will acknowledge all of these possible limitations and problems inherent in my idea, the first of which links to difficulties in quantifying harms. Although I did set out that table of different levels of harm and examples of things that might constitute different levels of harm, defining and measuring harm, particularly in the context of harms that stem from misuses of personal data and invasions of privacy, things like that, this can be inherently very, very challenging. It's very difficult to do. And again, the same friend whose quote I put up on the slide earlier, he said something else that was very relevant in this regard to me, which was simply, when it comes to working out how harmful a particular use of information might be to a specific person, you just really don't know. What might be completely innocuous to one person may not be at all to somebody else. Subjective experiences like embarrassment or anxiety are very difficult to quantify, which really makes it very difficult to determine an appropriate level of regulatory response. There is also necessarily some complexity inherent in what I've proposed, which is a criticism I know I've made already of the incumbent approach. I've set out my stall for why I think the definition of personal data gives rise to unnecessary and avoidable complexities. But the whole idea of calculating risk of harm, assuming we can quantify what harm means and to what kind of activities different levels of harm can be applied, this may still require quite complex risk assessments on behalf of data controllers to work out, well, how harmful is what we're doing? Even if we can say these are the levels of harm, these are the kind of harms we might expect, actually assessing whether what you're doing is, let's say, somewhat harmful, not harmful at all, or very harmful, that can be could be quite challenging to do, and again, could potentially demand expertise and resources that particularly smaller companies, smaller data controllers may not be able to afford or provide. There is, of course, as well, the potential for inconsistently performed risk assessments. Different organizations might interpret and apply these harm criteria very differently. This could lead to inconsistent levels of protection and application of the law. What one data controller might adjudge to be a very high level of risk, another may adjudge to be much less serious. This could obviously lead to different levels in application of the law, inconsistently and inconsistency. And do I have? Oh, time's not running out. Okay, sorry. I'm waiting for the sort of the 5 minutes to be held up or whatever it might be. And final 2 points. The problem with this harm-based approach, and I think this is quite a serious issue that I hadn't even thought of until fairly recently, but by looking at individual processing activities of data and trying to work out the harm level inherent in these activities, if we focus only on individual instances of harms, which this model I proposed essentially would aim to do, this may result in the overlooking of cumulative risks that arise when multiple data points are processed together. Sort of structural, long-term societal impacts of certain types of data processing, for example, may not be evident at the time the processing occurs. It may have a slower, insidious effect, and this model of regulation may struggle to deal with the problems arising from those sorts of situations, and it could result in the emergence of regulatory gaps and other things that we don't want. And the final criticism that is occasionally made of this type of approach is that adopting a harm-based approach to data protection, not only would it require a complete upheaval of the type of data protection law we've had in the UK for a very long time now, but it would also likely create tensions with other data protection frameworks outside the UK, particularly in the EU, which is still would still presumably be operating on a personal data-based approach. This would be politically very difficult for the UK with regards to the adequacy decision that the UK currently enjoys, or adequacy decisions the UK currently enjoys from the UK, from the EU. And it would, for businesses operating across borders, so companies that have operate internationally, ensuring compliance with two data protection regimes as opposed to just one, which is already complicated enough, could give rise to further difficulties and regulatory burdens and challenges. But nevertheless, these not necessarily insignificant challenges aside, I would like to think the idea, the model I have presented, does give us a nice alternative idea of what we could have, and for all its faults, could address and dissolve some of the problems inherent in the current framework. So I've gone on enough for today, I think, or talking for now anyway. So I'm going to leave it there and just say thank you very much for listening. And we can do whatever comes next now, I suppose. We'll just thank you.